dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to admire greatly the intelligence as well as the insights and wisdom of one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is David Goldman. He's better known in some circles by his nom de plume, or nom de guerre, as the case may be, Spengler, the title under which he operates at Asia Times, where he writes regularly. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die. It's good to catch up with him on train, as it were, in a visit just concluded in Washington, headed back to New York. David, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to catch up with you, as always.
Frank, it's always a pleasure and privilege to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you. David, as one of the guys who follows closely developments on Wall Street and in the capital markets and the financial sector more generally, I did want to ask you about an interesting turn of events. There is a company called Hikvision that has been operating quite successfully in China for some time now that the Chinese government uses to produce much of their surveillance technology for this comprehensive monitoring apparatus that they've been putting into place for Uyghurs and ordinary Chinese alike. This company has been present in American capital markets for some time, and it has recently been sort of exposed as a problem and is beginning to take something of a beating on the street. Talk us through that, if you would. What's going on there, and why shouldn't we be underwriting what Hikvision is up to?
I think it sends a very strong signal to the Chinese that the most reprehensible of their totalitarian practices step over a threshold that the United States will not accept. Obviously, the Chinese have enough money to fund their own companies if they have a national security priority. But there's no reason for us to help them in the case of firms which are being used for really reprehensible surveillance activities. So I think it's a good as a signaling. I don't think it makes a decisive strategic change.
Well, we'll see. And I guess in part it will depend on whether there's more of this to come, perhaps with other companies also in our capital markets or, you know, developing market indexes, for example. But let me turn to Huawei, a company that you know well. It has been much in the news in recent months, even especially the past few days, as the president has said he doesn't want American telecommunications networks to have its products in them. What do you make of what's going on with Huawei? Is it a threat as you see it? And if so, is this the right kind of step to be taking, as well as more generally to compete with them in the 5G space?
The Europeans are all saying that Huawei, which is by far the best and lowest cost equipment provider for fifth generation mobile broadband, will continue to roll out 5G in Europe. We've heard that directly from the heads of government of Germany, Holland, and France, and indirectly from the Poles and the Italians. So I don't think this by itself stops Huawei. But from an intelligence standpoint, all major telecom national champions are allied to their signals intelligence agencies. We know that Cisco did things for the National Security Agency from the Snowden revelations. And of course, we can expect that if the Chinese dominate the next generation of rollout, that will be of huge benefit to Chinese intelligence. We don't want that. The big question is, can we stop them? The Chinese are claiming they have self-sufficiency in enough components so they can work around any boycott we put on them. We have a strategic problem here. It's war in depth, and it's very hard to know exactly where we stand.
Yeah, there's a very interesting piece that you probably have seen that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald about the insights that the Australian government's intelligence services first provided to evidently an initially resistant U.S. government about the dangers associated with Huawei and its dominance of the 5G system. I hope that we'll have a chance to talk with the authors of this piece because it's quite revealing. But I did want to ask you, I think you mentioned Qualcomm as an issue, and there was a ruling that was handed down late yesterday, David Goldman, by a judge who's been hearing a case that the Federal Trade Commission brought against Qualcomm, an important American mobile phone chip manufacturer. And I wondered what you made of this ruling and what you think its implications might be for the competition with Huawei.
I think it's entirely stupid of the Federal Trade Commission to take this time to go after one of our national champions. Qualcomm and Huawei go head-to-head on a lot of key high-end chips. The Huawei has just developed the Kirin chipset, which competes with Qualcomm's handset chips for smartphones. There's a significant risk that Huawei may retaliate against American measures by launching a price war designed to try to force Qualcomm out of business. So they're very much in the front line of this fight. We've put them there. The United States government have put Qualcomm in the forefront of the fight on what we're doing. So to sandbag them with an FTC attack exactly at this point really tells me the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing in Washington.
Yeah. Well, the Chinese must be having a party over what's happened here, not least because, as you know, David, part of the case that the judge found convincing was made by Huawei in testimony against Qualcomm. But as a man who follows closely, you know, technology developments and specifically the sort of market and financial market dynamics behind them, in the absence of an industrial policy by the United States government, Qualcomm seems to be pretty much the only game in town for us. So should this result in a reduction of its competitiveness, to say nothing of putting it out of business, for heaven's sakes, this would be a body blow, would it not?
Absolutely. Huawei and Qualcomm are going head-to-head in an industry which is strategically critical. That's high-end chip design. And Huawei may take measures to try to hurt Qualcomm through a price war, for example, in retaliation for some of the measures that the government has taken against Huawei. So we should be backstopping our national champions and not sandbag.
This is the critical point that I hope is not lost on the Trump administration. I know they've been supporting Qualcomm. They've called it a national treasure. I think that they will surely want to make every effort to support Qualcomm in appealing this verdict and hopefully having it overturned. And I pray that the Ninth Circuit will break training and actually do the right thing for a change. But we'll see. We'll watch it closely, as I know will you. Thank you, David, very much for taking a few minutes to talk with us and for the great work you do at Asia Times and elsewhere. We'll look forward to taking stock with you again next week. Come back to us after a good Memorial Day and safe travels, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Rowan Scarborough about developments in the investigation of the investigators and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting, I'm pleased to say, with a man who joins us from time to time, not nearly often enough, though we'll try to fix that. His name is Rowan Scarborough. He's one of the best reporters on any subject in Washington, D.C., I believe. Most especially his coverage of, well, what's happening in the way of political warfare and the national security as it is impacted by that kind of activity, as well as the national interest, is without parallel. At the Washington Times, this is his beat. He's very generous with his time when we do call on him, and it's great to have him here. Thanks so much, virtually, that is. Welcome back, Rowan. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Frank.
So let me ask you, Rowan, to sort of do a quick, if you could, summation of what has been happening in this battle space of political warfare since Robert Mueller, the special counsel, dropped his report on the attorney general. And in the weeks that have followed from it, the thrashing involving contempt by the attorney general and the desire of Democrats to speak to Mueller, and then, of course, not least, what the attorney general has unleashed in the way of an investigation of the investigators.
So the Mueller report did not put this to rest, did it? He found that there was no conspiracy between Trump people in the Kremlin to interfere in the election by hacking and trolling, and that was supposed to be, some thought, the final word. Well, obviously it is not. There are at least four House committees run by Democrats now looking over all the same stuff, calling all the same witnesses. And in the process, they have found a new enemy to go after and try to destroy, and that's Bill Barr, because Barr wants to go in the same direction that Devin Nunes went, and he wants to find out how did this FBI probe into the Trump people get started anyway. I mean, we know the dossier had a lot to do with it. So, Frank, we have four committees that are doing a do-over of the Mueller report and throwing in obstruction of justice at the same time. And Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has a broad mandate now to investigate everything about the Trump family. He's actually hired prosecutors for the Intel Committee, a very, very odd choice of personnel if you're looking into counterintelligence. And I think one thing that came out of the transcripts that were released this week from Michael Cohen is Michael Cohen said repeatedly, and he was at the Trump Organization for over 15 years, that he never saw any Russian loans or Russian investments come into the Trump real estate empire. And that to me is a very telling disclosure, because part of Adam Schiff's mandate, part of his agenda, was that we're going to find money laundering and Russian influence at the Trump Organization. And here is Michael Cohen, somebody deep on the inside, said it never happened.
Yeah, this is just one of the peculiar turns of events which have upended a lot of the theories, the conspiracy theories, let us be clear, that are being touted today, even if after the end of this Mueller investigation. And I guess what you're saying, Rowan Scarborough, is that they're going to continue investigating it until they get the answer that they want, not actually satisfy themselves with the factual information that Bob Mueller has supplied.
That's right, Frank. And we know Adam Schiff, you can make a list of false allegations that he has publicly uttered without really any reckoning on his part, going back and admitting that he's wrong. So if this is a lawmaker who read from the dossier at the opening hearing of the House Intel investigation on March 20th, 2017, he read the unverified, now we know false, conspiracy charges in the dossier and named names. He branded Trump people as lawbreakers. So he will, if he's willing to do that and level other charges against Trump people that were never verified and some were proven to be untrue, then he's going to come up with something. He's going to say he has found a Russian bought a condo under an assumed name or something, so he can hurl more allegations at the president. We can count on that.
Yeah. Just to keep this thing going, whether they decide to press ahead with impeachment of President Trump or not, I think it's fair to say this political warfare is going to continue and ramp up. And you've been thinking and writing about, I think, Rowan, one of the important enablers of all of this, which is, of course, the media. There's a new book out by Mark Levin on the subject, but you have also been connecting the dots, shall we say, between what the Mueller team in particular had done and these, media echo chambers that Ben Rhodes famously described them as, to promote this false narrative of collusion with the Russians. Tell us about it.
That's right. The liberal mainstream media, what I call the New York Times media, was out front from the get-go in pushing the false P Trump Kremlin conspiracy narrative. And they wrote stories that we now know today were completely wrong. For example, they wrote, the New York Times, CNN, others wrote about these intercepts that supposedly existed for over a year of Trump people talking to the Kremlin intelligence during the election. Wow. I mean, what a bombshell if true that is. But it wasn't true. I mean, obviously, if that was true, the Mueller report wouldn't have concluded that there was no conspiracy. They would have said there was a conspiracy. You know, Manafort talked to this person, the Trump family talked to this person, but they didn't. And what I find a bit odd, Frank, is that when you read the Mueller report, its bottom line is no conspiracy. Yet they, in footnotes, they cite scores of liberal news media stories that promoted the conspiracy. Some of the stories that they footnoted, the New York Times, the CNN, turned out to be wrong. Yet by footnoting them, they gave these stories credibility. I mean, if the average person wants to look up these stories, they'll read there was a conspiracy. So I found it very odd that prosecutors who had first-person witnesses before the grand jury to tell them the narrative instead relied also on scores of news stories to write the narrative when they didn't have to. It was a very odd combination, I found, Frank, when the conclusion was that there was no conspiracy.
There is a lot of speculation, Rowan, and I'd just like your thoughts on this, that the real purpose of much of the Mueller document, not all that surprisingly, given the character of the various attorneys who prepared it as Democratic or Hillary Clinton partisans, was to essentially help Congress make the case that there should be an impeachment of Donald Trump. So having those kinds of citations, even where they were directly contradicted by the body of the report itself, I imagine had that as a motivating factor. Do you think?
Oh, I have no doubt that the Clinton loyalists who were on Mueller's team wanted to write a roadmap that the Democrats could use to impeach Trump, but they didn't man up, so to speak. If that was their motive, then they should have concluded that he obstructed justice and say why they came to that conclusion. Instead, they punted the Bill Barr. You know, of course, putting him right in the bullseye of Democrats, because the Mueller's people knew what Bill Barr was going to do. He was going to look at this mismatch of various things that Trump said and conclude, well, this is an obstruction of justice. For one reason, there was no underlying crime. There was no conspiracy. So you're right, Frank. They punted for a reason. They wanted Bill Barr to make the call, so they wouldn't be embarrassed. And then, but they gave enough information to Jerry Nadler et al. to come up with something. And look at the people that Nadler has added to his staff. He brought in two outside attorneys who wrote an article for the Brookings Institution, which created like 30 different crimes that Trump people have committed. That they didn't. I mean, if you read the Mueller report, they didn't do these things. They may have been a few political mistakes, but they were not felonies. But that's the mindset that he has brought into that committee staff, where everything people did is potentially a felony.
Well, and I'm sure they will be prosecuting that case if they can. Quickly, Rowan Scarborough, lastly, John Bolton has been subjected, talking about the echo chamber, to a withering assault by Ben Rhodes's ilk, who have been claiming he's determined to get President Trump into a war with Iran and other activities that are at odds with the president's own policy directions and preferences. What do you make of this attack, and is there any ground for it as you could see it?
You know, John Bolton has always been a target for the left. He was not confirmed as UN ambassador. You know, he had to take a recess appointment, and the Democrats would not confirm him for measly reasons. He was intimately qualified for that job.
Well, I think, in fact, wasn't it Joe Biden who said you're too qualified? Or maybe it was John Kerry. I'm not sure. One of them was of the view that he couldn't be given this job because he's too capable.
I mean, long before John Bolton came to the White House, Trump had ushered in a new get tough on Iran policy. This predated John Bolton's arrival, and the sanctions that the Trump administration has added in pulling out of the nuclear deal has put a lot of Iran is feeling the pressure. Economic sanctions, if everybody chips in, they actually work.
Rowan, thank you so much for covering this ground with us, as always, as well as what you do every day in that regard at the Washington Times. I know you'll keep it up. I hope you come back to us again soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Matt Brodsky about developments in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East, including the new peace initiative of Jared Kushner. That and more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Matt Brodsky, a man that we consult with about matters involving the Middle East, in which he has considerable insights. He has been reporting and writing and thinking about these issues for many years, including at places like the Jewish Policy Center. He is also a frequent contributor to the various outlets like the Daily Caller that are important sources of information about all of these public policy issues, and we're grateful to him for taking a few minutes to talk with us about them. Matt, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be with you.
I wanted to ask you first about something you did write about recently, Matt, namely the Iranian hand in the attacks that Israel was subjected to from Gaza. We're often encouraged to believe that Sunnis and Shia can't collaborate with one another, and yet in this case, as there are other examples, they have made common cause, the Sunnis of Hamas and the Shia of Iran, to attack a common enemy, namely the State of Israel. Tell us what the evidence is that this was actually Iran's doing through their Hamas proxies.
Well, this all fits in the wider context of Iran trying to demonstrate that it and its proxies can strike up a war and make things difficult for the U.S. and its allies throughout the entire region. It's not just in the Straits of Hormuz and the Arabian or Persian Gulf, but through Syria, through Lebanon, of course, and in Gaza, which I think people more associate with Hamas since they're in control. It's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, though, that is a proxy that is essentially run by Iran. And in this the previous round that happened over a weekend saw 690 rockets launched. That began with a Palestinian Islamic Jihad sniper taking a shot across the Gaza fence at an Israeli commander. So they began the operation. The rockets that they used, they unveiled a newer rocket that is most analysts think is based on Iranian technology. But also when you look at who Israel targeted in its response, half of those it killed were Palestinian Islamic Jihad members. They were the most active over the course of the weekend. And what that is doing from Iran's perspective is to show Israel specifically that not only does it have terror tunnels from Hezbollah and many rockets from Lebanon, and not only are they entrenching themselves within Syria, but they can also open a third front from Gaza. And that is all happening at the same time that it can threaten U.S. interests in Saudi Arabia from Yemen and from Iraq and through its militias that it has there, including the transfer of longer range, 700 kilometer range rockets into Western Iraq that can put Tel Aviv in range and large parts of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Matt Brodsky, I wanted to ask you about one other item that I think you refer to in this article in the Washington Free Beacon, is that Iran's technology is being drawn upon by Hamas for these attacks. How does that technology get into their hands, given that Israel has, as I understand it, had a pretty tight quarantine on access to Gaza, especially now that the Egyptians are supposedly keeping their part of that territory sealed off?
That's a good question, and that's something clearly the Israelis are most concerned about. The rockets so far have not been precision guided from Gaza. And so from Israel's threat assessment, they're more concentrated on the northern theater with the type of rockets that they are able to ship through Iraq and what they're able to ship into Lebanon. Syria has increasingly become a more difficult arena for Iran to transfer weapons through because Israel has been fairly successful there. In Gaza, it's a creeping type of threat that continues, but Netanyahu, as prime minister, has been reluctant to do a much wider operation there, mostly because it would change the focus from to Israel's south as opposed to the north, where the much larger Iranian threat looms.
But is it presumed to be coming in from the sea? And isn't Israel trying to maintain essentially a blockade of those waters? I know there's a lot of talk when these attacks take place that one of the things that the Palestinians demand is more areas in which they can do fishing operations. That's always, I think, been seen as a vehicle for getting smuggled items into the country. But talk us through that, if you would, Matt Brodsky.
Right. That is a nonstop issue. And incidentally, what always tends to factor into to ceasefires. Like, for instance, as part of the ceasefire from the last round in Gaza, Israel agreed to increase the area outside of Gaza in the waters where Gazans can go fishing. Then a day or so ago, there was an incident that occurred and Israel curtailed that. So this is one of the main ways that they would be getting rocket technology. But beyond that, it's technology also that the terrorist groups within Gaza are able to use and to copy. And that's why you could see from what Israel bombed, they were going after these type of underground factories. All of this is an Iranian blueprint that they use in Lebanon and they've used in Syria and elsewhere, underground manufacturing facilities.
Matt, let me switch gears here, not altogether, but to a different sort of theater, shall we say, for the Israelis to contend with the Palestinian threat. And that is Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is said to be now poised to roll out at last the plan for a new peace initiative that has been in the works, I think, from practically the beginning of the Trump administration. The first foray in this effort will be a conference in Bahrain towards the end of next month. I understand that you have some insights into what's going on here. To the extent you can share with us those insights, tell me what you think is afoot and its prospects.
I think the conference that they're hosting in Bahrain on June 25th and 26th is designed to create an economic blueprint for investment to paint a picture for the Palestinian people at this point, I think more so than the leadership, of what the future could look like. And I think that's very important because as time continues to tick, the clock ticks, what we're seeing is a larger disparity between the leadership of the Palestinians in the West Bank, who essentially are getting rather comfortable with the status quo, and the people who would like a better life in a way that can see many of their aspirations looked after. So this economic conference is to kind of create momentum to come in with sugar and do that before releasing the parts of the political plan, which the administration has said will address the core issues in the conflict. Mm.
To the extent that all of this presupposes as have various peace processes in the past, a disregard for sort of the tenets of Sharia, which certainly Hamas embraces in a full-throated way and the Palestinian Authority does more or less, namely that any territory that is ever held by Muslims can never be relinquished, can never ultimately be turned over permanently to non-Muslims, let alone Jews. This would seem to me to be likely, as have previous initiatives, to come to naught. What do you make of that hard-learned lesson, Matt Brodsky?
Well, first, the administration has been quite clear in stressing that from their perspective, they see security as the number one issue for Israel, and of course, they're going to protect that. Number two is they're quick to point out that by adhering to calcified talking points, as the Palestinian leadership does, it has gotten them nothing. And there is, as we say, a disparity now between them and the people, because this isn't going to lead anywhere forward for Palestinian aspirations. They're simply not going to be able to adhere to a Sharia type of law in any form of future and threaten Israel. So, I mean, that is all taken into account in what the administration is going to present. But the fact is, and this is why the focus is on the economy, that's to begin with, is because these are actual real tangible things that can improve the day-to-day life of Palestinians, which is hopefully something that will, once they have a taste of that, this is something that they would embrace and say, well, we would like more opportunities, not less. And what we see in Gaza and from Hamas is certainly not something that they would want to emulate in the West Bank.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thesis, and we'll see it tested here, I guess, shortly. My personal assessment has been that whatever the aspirations of the Palestinian people may be, they will be forced to submit to the dictates of Sharia, which will preclude any such concessions to the Israelis, and continuing privation, presumably, for the Palestinian people. Well, Matt Brodsky, I know you'll be on top of this, and we'll look forward to your reporting on it, and I appreciate your taking the time to visit with us today concerning the latest on what's happening with Iran and the Middle East more generally. Next up, we'll speak with J. Michael Waller about what might be developing in Russia in the way of opposition to Vladimir Putin, and what is unfortunately playing out in terms of opposition to the opposition to Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. That and more, straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Mike Waller, J. Michael Waller, PhD to be precise, our Vice President at the Center for Security Policy for Government Relations. Mike is a duty expert on many of the topics we cover here at Secure Freedom Radio, and particularly knowledgeable about and a gifted practitioner of the art of political warfare. We're going to visit with him about some of that that's being waged at the moment. Mike, it's good to have you back as always. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Frank.
So let's start with Venezuela. There seems to be a fair amount of political warfare going on there, as well as some of the kinetic kind, to keep Maduro, Nicolas Maduro, Hugo Chavez's successor, in power. In part, this is being enabled by foreign powers, many of them from outside of our hemisphere, notably Russia, China, and Iran, but also, of course, Cuba. You've been following this story closely. Give us a read on what's happening there and what the prospects are.
Well, last fall, the Center for Security Policy issued a decision brief saying that we should start arming a Venezuelan resistance army because that's the only way to overthrow the narco regime of Maduro. U.S. government disagreed with that approach, and they decided to take an approach to simply try the political process working within the Venezuelan constitutional system. That didn't work. And so you had a very strong, huge popular movement against the government, millions of people taking to the streets, and the leader, Juan Guaido, who we recognize as officially as the interim president of Venezuela, failed to mobilize those huge crowds to his advantage, and as a result, got defeated.
You say defeated. Is that a temporary thing? Is that a permanent thing? I understand that he's engaging in negotiations, or his representatives are, with the Maduro regime in Norway. Not entirely clear whether that's a surrender parley by one or the other of the parties, but what do you make of his prospects at the moment?
Well, when you negotiate from a position of weakness and you really have no assets to you anymore aside from diplomatic recognition, and you're losing a lot of the support of the people who came out to the streets and risked their lives for you, you're effectively negotiating your own surrender. And that's the problem with Venezuela, because he's trying to negotiate an end to Nicolas Maduro being president of Venezuela, but he's not really trying to negotiate an end to the regime itself, which means it's a Cuban-run secret police system and a Cuban-controlled army and a whole narco-smuggling apparatus that props everything up. He's not trying to negotiate any of that away, and there's no way you can negotiate those things away.
Yeah. If he were successful in getting rid of Maduro, let's just say, despite his lack of leverage and other weaknesses, might those other things go over the side in due course?
No, because you're putting a weakling there instead of a strong man like Maduro. And Guaido is a weakling in this regard, and those elements will simply control him.
That's a grim prospect, Mike Waller. This needs to be taken very seriously, and I hope the administration of Donald Trump is doing just that. Let me turn to another area of considerable interest to you, Mike, Russia. The Russian people, not so much necessarily in Moscow, but elsewhere around the country, are seemingly increasingly restive under their strongman, Vladimir Putin. You've talked about a Maidan movement taking hold, perhaps, in that country. Remind us what the Maidan phenomenon is and why you think this might be a possibility in Russia and what we could do to encourage it.
This is a really exciting time in Russia because for the first time, people are starting to talk in a broad way about life after Putin. I think we in the United States, especially the people running the apparatus in the United States, like they were with the Soviets, sort of can't imagine Russia without Putin. And just as they fought the dissolution of the USSR, and when really Putin's regime is very fragile. What gives it strength is the fear that we show of it and the sanctions we impose on all of the oligarchs rather than selectively apply them so that they'll fight among themselves. Once the oligarchs start fighting among themselves, that's going to be the end of Putin. But what you have now in Russia is a resurgence of public protest against the Putin government and against the very legitimacy of the government from the regions. So it's not just Moscow. It's cities ranging from those in the industrialized western part of Russia all the way up to the Arctic and the Far East and Siberia. Widespread movements organized spontaneously at the city level, town level, and coordinated online. So it's a very exciting time to be anticipating change in Russia.
Tie into that, if you would, Mike, the evidence that the Russian military is becoming increasingly concerned that the Western culture, about which we spend a lot of time complaining, is having an insidious effect on the youth of Russia today.
Yeah, this is a big concern because part of Putin's national security strategy is to create either the reality or the illusion of a revived Great Russia and Great Russian culture. And that means that state sponsorship of the Orthodox, Russian Orthodox Christianity religion, their not only restoring, but building a lot of churches across the country. Putin's sponsoring that. And so those are, to me, many positive approaches to Russia. But what they are also doing is fighting this Western encroachment of the mindset of Russian youth, which is everything from gaming to Hollywood to other popular culture to LGBTQ to a lot of the libertine aspects of Western culture that traditionalists really hate and that that more isolated societies like Russia really fear. And so when you're getting these mindsets into Russian teenagers, and those Russian teenagers form the bulk of the conscript Russian army, and they represent Russia's future, you can see how people like Putin and his military commander are getting really frightened. So they're trying to, the military is stepping into the Russian civilian school system to try to put an end to this.
Interesting. And again, something that we might want to capitalize on if we can. Mike, let me turn to one other issue that you've been focused on. I know it's important to both of us. That is the idea of designating the Muslim Brotherhood as the foreign terrorist organization that it is. The president has committed to do that effectively in a speech that he made back in Youngstown, Ohio on the 15th of August, 2016, where he talked about stripping out and removing the networks that are radicalizing in our communities, radical Islamic terrorist networks, that is. He was obviously talking about the Muslim Brotherhood in that context. And I know there was an early effort shortly after he came to office to do such a designation. It came to naught, I think, primarily because of the presence of people like Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis in the key national security departments. But there seems now to be a fresh look being taken. What are you hearing, and what could we do to encourage that designation? And why is it so important, as you see it?
Well, first, it's a very exciting thing that the president has reportedly committed to designating the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist organization, because the entire national security establishment seems to be against him. They want to continue the Obama policy of considering Islamists, jihadist forces like the Muslim Brotherhood, to be allies against violent extremism, and let the extremists who are not presently violent in our country not only get away with it, but be viewed as part of the solution. So Trump is really going against the entire establishment on this, as is his national security advisor, John Bolton. The president is also committed. I mean, he's got so much on his plate, and he still doesn't have a real team in this regard, but he's committed to keeping his campaign promises. And he takes pride when he realizes that he has fulfilled another campaign promise. And I think once this is really brought to his attention for him to focus on, it's just a matter of him signing a document designating the Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. That way we can go after front groups like CARE and these other Islamist organizations that have been plaguing all of us.
Yeah. High time that be done, needless to say. Mike Waller, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy, as well as for your visits with us from time to time. We hope to talk to you again very soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.